Welcome to Inspiring People and Places, where we interview national leaders in the architectural, engineering, construction, and development industry in an effort to educate, innovate, and inspire industry professionals to disrupt the status quo, improve their project teams, and steward public and private investments more effectively. I'm your host, BJ Kramer, President and CEO of MCFA. Allow me to introduce today's guest.
A very special episode of Inspiring People and Places today. It's special because we're turning the table. Today, host becomes guest and guest becomes host. Our normal host, BJ Kramer, interviewed me on Inspiring People and Places a few months ago, and I asked if I could interview him. I'm excited today to plumb those depths. My name is John Nelson, Chief Financial Officer at MCFA. My guest today is BJ Kramer, a friend, a business partner, a one-time protege, and now the leader of MCFA, the growing architecture, engineering, and construction firm that I now call home. BJ, welcome to your podcast.
Thanks, buddy. I'm not usually nervous, but you just made me nervous. So let's see how this goes.
Let me hold your hand through it, and we'll because I have a lot to ask you. The normal format on the podcast, of course, is that it's split in three parts: discover, navigate, and accelerate. And we'll stick with that, but maybe with some variation.
All right.
Because I want license here to descend into the particulars, as Malcolm Gladwell says, if you say something really compelling.
License is all yours.
All right. So let's start it out just as you start out.
Can I make a qualifier real quick?
Please.
I usually give at least some questions, and everybody at least had the option to listen to my podcast. So I know nothing about what John's about to ask me.
That's right. I haven't told you. Here's what I'll reveal. Like, you know the game 20 questions you play as a kid?
Yeah.
Well, I have 19 for you.
All right. We'll see how far we
get through them.
All right.
All right. So let's just start out, BJ, with you just giving us a quick biographic sketch.
Okay. Second of four kids, oldest boy, girl, boy, girl, boy. Parents, my dad was an accountant and an Air Force officer, flew C-130s. My mom was at first a gym teacher, Catholic school gym teacher, and then later a CCD coordinator or religious education coordinator. Grew up in Northeast Philly, two Cinnamons in New Jersey. Let's see what's relevant. I think it's relevant that I swam growing up. That was probably my number one sport, or was my number one sport. Helped me get into college. Went to West Point, studied systems engineering there, swam all 4 years. Let's see. Graduated in 2004, went to the officer basic course at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. Returned to West Point as a graduate assistant on the swim team for 9 months, where I was both a graduate assistant, which is a second lieutenant, kind of supporting the swim team, and I was also an associate supporting the athletic department in the facilities department there. Went to Fort Hood, Texas with the 4th Infantry Division, deployed to Baghdad, Iraq, did route clearance as a platoon leader, and then later a company executive officer, came back from Iraq. Plenty to dive into if we go into Iraq, but I'm trying to hit the high notes. Came back, was supposed to take command of my unit, went to the captain's career course, had a co-op degree program there where I went to what is now, or was the first graduating class or master's class of Missouri University of Science and Technology. Got a utilization assignment out of there with the Corps of Engineers. So instead of going back to Fort Hood, there's a whole story there. I went to move to Baltimore with the Philadelphia District Corps of Engineers, kind of an interesting situation there, but was on the C4ISR construction program where I met MCFA as a resident engineer for the Philly District Corps of Engineers as a captain in the Army. From there, I got off active duty. I kind of struck out on my own in real estate development. Was kind of wearing a hat, striking out on my own in real estate development, and at the same time was half-time working for a construction management advisory firm, an 8A firm in the federal market. Then I came back to MCFA, or came to MCFA. That's 2012. 2012 joined. 2018 was named managing partner. 2019 bought majority ownership. All kinds of stories in between, and all the while was still in the Army Reserves, had a couple of different assignments in the Army Reserves, and had three kids and got married along the way.
I was glad you didn't leave that out, the family part.
That's most important.
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about West Point in particular, because I think that might be the part of your story that is the least relatable to the rest of us.
Okay.
And there's a lot there I'd like to understand.
Yeah.
So I looked it up. West Point currently has, according to Google, an 11% admissions rate. Okay. So for every 100 people who apply, only 11 are accepted there. But if you think about that, the selectivity, how elite the place is far higher than 11%, because that pool of people that's drawn to a place like West Point is not your normal pool, I would guess.
I'll agree.
In terms of people who, you know, have the mental acumen, the physical stamina, and the, what we say, the commitment and the character to want to go to a place like that and want that kind of experience. So, BJ, do you feel like a 3 sigma, 4 sigma, or 5 sigma guy?
It's a good question.
So there's this concept in BJ studied, he said systems engineering.
Yeah, 6 sigma.
So there's this concept of 6 sigma, which means in any business process, the goal, if it's a 6 sigma goal, your goal is to have no more than 3 defects in a million chances, a million times running your process. So what I'm saying to BJ in code here kind of is, are you 7 in 100? Are you 7 in 1,000? Are you 3 in 10,000? Or are you 3 in 1,000,000?
I'm not 3 in 1,000,000. I think I will come at it with all humility and say I'm probably the one that kind of scraped my way in. I think if you look at swimming, 2 people in every event make it to the Olympics. I was nowhere near an Olympic level swimmer, but I was probably the top 1% of swimmers in the world. So, you know, I was a Division I athlete. I think that, you know, that gives you some competitive advantage. But when you sit down next to your classmates there, I can look around the room and say, well, I'm here because of swimming. There were far greater classmates than me. So I thought I was lucky to get in.
One of my jobs here today, I think, is to, you're a humble person. I've gotten to know you and work with you side by side. I know you to be a humble person. One of my jobs here today is to not let you get away with sandbagging, though. All right. So I'm going to try to not do
All right.
that. Let me take you to a moment in time. Okay. You're 18 years old. You learn that West Point is interested in having you there. All right. Your friends are running off to who knows where, Rutgers or Penn State or Princeton or wherever they're going, and they're going to have fun. And they're going to study something, I don't know, like sociology. They're going to meet co-eds. They're going to join fraternities, whatever. But you said, no, that's not for me.
I didn't say that, actually. The prestige was probably the number one thing making me willing to sacrifice. It was like, all right, this is something you can't pass up. But I remember I reported on June 29th. And so 1 weekend, before 1 weekend, it's 5 a.m. on 4th of July, and the cadet first sergeant is just barking at us. You know, all of your friends are waking up hungover. They just graduated from high school, and they are just enjoying all summer long at the beach with their friends and yada, yada, yada. And in that moment, I was like, what the hell did I get myself into? But I think I was 17 when I reported. And I remember the day I got in, I was at a swim meet, and I was actually talking to my dad right before that. Like, if I don't get in there, do I take a post-grad year and improve in swimming? Do I go to a prep school? Because I think I was almost 100% convinced I was meant to go to West Point. And then that next week, I got the letter of admission.
So how long did it take you to get over that feeling of what have I done?
4 years.
Okay. Funny questions. Last one about West Point, I promise. Was it fun there?
So I just said this line to somebody else. You go through it and you're surviving. There's definitely moments of fun. Like, you're not a psychopath robot that's a cadet. You're definitely finding your pockets of fun. But for the most part, you're living from fun to fun and just surviving whatever the week when you're a senior between a football game to a football game, or, you know, a Labor Day to Thanksgiving pass when you're a plebe. It's kind of like get in the mud, crawl through it, and there's some incremental light at the end of the next tunnel before you jump back into the
So utter misery punctuated with moments of fun. It sounds like fatherhood. That's great. All right. So let's shift gears. Let's talk about your mom.
Yeah.
Your mom finds out that she's sending her son off to the Army. And of course, your dad was a military man, as you mentioned, so it wasn't entirely unfamiliar. But this is her oldest son.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember that interaction? Was she reluctant to have you go?
I don't. I think that she had sacrificed so much throughout my dad's career. You know, he was in Desert Storm in 1990. She was at home with four kids. I think we were 10, 8, 6, and 4, or 8, 6, 4, and 2 at the time. I think that she was so proud to be a military spouse. If you meet her, she bleeds red, white, and blue and is usually wearing it. I think that by the way, the world was not at war when I reported there. So I think in all of our minds, Desert Storm was this anomaly, a blip on the radar. It was 10 years ago. There weren't dots connected between what she was thinking. She was probably as caught up and proud of the prestige and the acceptance, maybe a little shocked at my acceptance there, that war wasn't on her mind.
Mm-hmm. And that was soon to change.
9/11 changed the game for all of us.
What year were you?
The class that graduated that year gets a lot of publicity as the first class to graduate in war. We were the first class to commit. So we were rising sophomores. We're sophomores when it happened. The next year you have to commit. So you can leave debt-free with 2 years of education for free before you sign the dotted line your junior year. So first week of junior year, there's a affirmation ceremony, I think it's called. And so class 2004 was the first class to sign the dotted line to stay after 9/11.
After 9/11.
Going into war.
Got it. Wow. All right, let's shift gears again.
Taking me back to some crazy memories.
I know, but it's an interesting moment because I don't know that I know any 17 or 18-year-old kid that would be capable of that decision. And I'm having kids of my own, it's really an interesting moment for me. So thanks for sharing.
Yeah.
All right. On Memorial Day last year, you did one of the most memorable podcasts I've ever heard with a woman named Marion Zielinski. She recounted her memories of her 23-year-old son, Dennis Zielinski, who was killed in Iraq on November 19th, 2005. Her heart-wrenching story has been told in the New York Times. Raising a Son, Mourning a Soldier was the name of the article. Mm-hmm. I'd like you to talk, if you would, about Dennis Zielinski.
All right. It was easier to interview her than to talk about him. All right. So Dennis and I were same year, both swimmers, both from New Jersey. Met him prior to going to West Point because my sister and one of his high school best friends were swimming together at Rowan University. So we were very early on the two plebes from Jersey. Although in any other circle, I claim Philadelphia as my hometown. Important to point out because he's a New York Yankees, Giants, and anyway.
He was glad to let you have Philly.
Yeah. Our class started with, I think, 9 or 10 swimmers. And by the end, we had 4 of us left. It might have even been more. I can't remember plebe summer. So we had a pretty tight group, Charlie Lewis, Ron Garberson, Dennis Zielinski, and myself. Dennis was unanimously voted our team captain by the 3 of us. So when you go to school, in many circles, people look at me, maybe he went to West Point, leader. When you're a leader among leaders and it is obvious, you know there's something special there. And it might be a word, it might be a smile, it might be a hug. Everybody's bigger than me. So it's not necessarily size, presence, but a special, special guy. And ended up being our first classmate killed in Iraq. And what's interesting is when we were plebes, there was a gentleman named David Bernstein who was a senior on the swim team, and Dennis wasn't traveling with the team. Dave wasn't traveling with the team at the time. And they were on this like D relay that, they hyped themselves up. And David was killed October of 2003. And that was the first West Point cadet that we knew that was killed. And Dennis was the one, I believe, maybe it was a group idea, that we would commission ourselves After graduation, you go to a commissioning ceremony and everybody breaks out and does their own commissioning ceremony. So the four swimmers got commissioned together at David Bernstein's graveside as kind of a reminder to ourselves of like those who sacrificed before us and what, you know, what we were signing up for. And Dennis was, you know, a year later or a year after graduation, and 2 weeks before I was deploying, Dennis deployed in September of 2005. I deployed in December of 2005, and he was killed in Beji, Iraq by a roadside bomb or a deep buried IED, November 19th, 2005. And
you grew up in a hurry.
Yeah. Yeah. And maybe the hurry, the exclamation point on that hurry is November 19th, 2005, I get the call from his mom. I remember it to this moment. And within, I don't know, 10 days, we were going home for Thanksgiving anyway. We're getting ready to deploy. We knew like Thanksgiving was kind of our last hurrah. There's a lot of mini stories around this, but here's what happened. I went home for Thanksgiving. My parents said, we have to go up to see the Zelenskys. I said that, and they said, we'll go with you. And I remember my dad collapsing on the floor into Mr. Zelensky's arms and witnessing what that pain looks like at home. 3 days later, I gave his eulogy, and 5 days after that, I was on a plane into Kuwait. So that's Dennis Zelensky, the friend, cadet, and soldier, and his life has certainly probably inspired me more than anything else to try to become the best version of myself.
I'm glad you hit that note at the end, because that's exactly why I wanted for you to tell that story. One skill I've noticed, BJ, that you have is it looks to me like you peer into the future a lot. And you peer into the future and you see things. And I'm talking about business now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you do this in your personal life, you could tell me, but in business, I noticed that you tend to look into the future and kind of squint, and you see things that others don't see, and then you sort of will that future state into existence. And first of all, I'm curious if that resonates. And secondly, if it does, where does it come from?
It does resonate. Where does it come from? I made a commitment to myself when I got home from Iraq. One of my best friends didn't get that chance. So it was a blessing and a curse in many ways. But it was the only way I knew to honor him was to squeeze as much out of this life as possible. And that's not just fun. That's not just doing a lot of things. It's impact. And so, you know, while nobody can have an impact of two lives, I felt really cheated that for him, that he didn't get to live. So I think a little bit, maybe a lot of what I see is less about what am I doing day to day and what is going to be the whole or gross impact of my existence. And therefore, I look, you know, I often quote Steve Jobs, we're here to put a dent in the universe. I kind of use that as my motivation. And Dennis inspired this behavior. Everything else has been kind of a lesson learned and a stepping stone towards becoming this future version of myself that I want to have an impact, because if I can, then I'm part of his blast radius. And even though he didn't get to be here for 70, 80, 90, 100 years, the impact he had on me is sure as shit going to have a bigger impact than it would have had he not passed.
Let's talk about the present version of yourself.
Okay.
Okay. And I think you hit on some notes there that have me thinking. I take it that you have a business philosophy?
Sure. Yeah.
Can you describe it?
Yeah, you'll be disappointed here, or anybody that knew me as a second lieutenant that knows, like, we had to actually write our leadership philosophy down to present to our platoon. I probably have a whole bunch of different anecdotal principles, but I don't have it spelled out completely, but I think it goes something like this. Profits are important. People are more important. And every person you touch, you have a chance to create value in the world. And whether that value is helping them change the trajectory of their life or just helping them have a better day, take ownership of every moment that you have. And whatever your platform is, try to do as much good with it as possible. And what that comes down to me is, if I am striving and becoming the best version of myself in any given moment, it's likely to inspire others to do the same. Inspiring People and Places is brought to you by MCFA. MCFA is a CVE verified, service-disabled, veteran-owned small business. At MCFA, our why is to inspire people and places through project leadership. We provide planning, strategy, program management, and construction management support services to a wide variety of public and private sector clients.
Can I tell you a story?
Yeah.
You were probably 28, 29 years old, getting out of the Army, came to work at MCFA. Mm-hmm. And I had this idea. I wanted to do something completely different with my time. I wanted to write a book. And I just couldn't really get started. I didn't know why. I had an idea. I just couldn't really get started. And I met you providentially, and you came into our company and into my life. And we were talking one day, and you said, "I'll show up every day at 7 a.m. and just sit here just to keep you accountable and keep you on task for writing that book." So I think a moment ago when you said that it's about doing what you can do to make other people better, folks, he's not making it up. He really lives it. And I felt that. I've always remembered that. I've never told you that.
I appreciate that. I don't remember it. Sounds like me, though.
Sounds like you. All right. You read a lot, and you read a lot about business. So,
yeah.
So tell me one or two reads that have really mattered to your philosophy and your approach.
Never Eat Alone. Can't remember the name of the gentleman.
We'll find it.
It was a bunch of different. It's one that just comes to my head right away. It talked about basically maybe some of this, like, hey, every person that you get to sit down with, every time you broaden your network and make connection, you're creating value in the world. It's not financial value. It's not transactional value. It's like karma value. When you meet somebody and you can have a good conversation and impart some knowledge on them or them on you, hopefully both, like you just made the world a little better, a little smarter, a little wiser. So that one stands out. Yeah. Another quick anecdote from that was it also, I always said to myself, I'm terrible at remembering people's names. And one of the stories in there is how Bill Clinton would network and work around the room. And every night he would go back and write on the back of a card who he met and some detail about them, their kids' names, something. And he's apparently masterful at remembering millions of people's names. And it's a tactic I'm not quite 100% disciplined at, but I try to be a little intentional about. The other tactic there is don't tell yourself you can't remember people's names, because every time you say that, you're actually talking yourself into like, you're not good at that. And that's like a positive psychology thing. All right. That's one book. Think and Grow Rich, 4-Hour Work Week, How to Win Friends and Influence People. The books that shape me are pretty interesting. I know I ask a lot about books. Oh, The Greatest Salesman in the World by Og Mandino. That thing reads like a prayer. That's a worthy read. I'll go with all of those.
That's a good list, but I have to ask, any cons in reading a lot? Any drawbacks?
Yes, absolutely. If you read too much and don't have a methodology for implementation, it turns into infotainment. So you got a whole bunch of competing. I read 4-Hour Work Week or listen to it or parts of it probably annually. But the danger with the 4-Hour Work Week, it can convince you to be lazy. And it creates this narrative in your head like, you're not being lazy, you're being effective and you're being smarter. And like, I'm aware of it now. But early on, it was like, wait a second. And he talks about this. The intention was never to be lazy. The intention was to create a revenue stream that takes care of your day-to-day needs so that you can go focus on where you think you can create the most impact. So if you can make a living on 4 hours a week, then you can go make a life out of whatever your true calling is. So I really do love that book, but the title is provocative and the content can be misinterpreted, I think. So I think the one habit I have picked up is when you're reading, as soon as you've gotten the nugget of what you've read, write it down think about how you can apply it in your life, and then go teach it to somebody else. And that's the way to start really. Again, I'm probably betting 300 on that habit, but it's better than zero.
What I would worry about is it creating too much mind noise when you're trying to operate in the world. It's a lot of ideas flying at you and relies, I think, on your ability to synthesize those things and in some cases, choose between competing ideas maybe.
Which I think is critical thinking, right? Synthesizing and choosing is the thinking that you need out of leaders. So in some ways, I say you kind of have to keep at it because that's being responsible with what's coming at you. There's not a book that's been written that doesn't have some non-truths in it. You got to be able to discern that. And the more you read, the more you can. It's like, again, not going off the rails here, but watching Fox News and CNN and somewhere in between kind of making an interpretation for yourself is critical thinking. And, you know, wait, I don't understand that. I'm going to go look up an article on that. What did this guy, what's this guy's background? What's this gal's background? What is their perspective? Where's that coming from? All of that really teaches you a dynamic nature of how to cut through information and in many ways cut through bullshit.
So what I'm hearing is you have to have a discipline around your reading habit. The thing I would worry about is if I'm reading too many business ideas, it's really hard to just internalize those for synthesis. What a natural tendency might be is to externalize those. And you're trying to run an organization.
Yep.
And if you every week come in with a new idea and you externalize it, that could create a lot of chaos.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that talk about the management book of the week. Oh, now BJ's reading this. Now BJ's reading that. I am very, very, very disciplined on who I brainstorm ideas with. And I actually, the lesson is actually learned through MCFA. I know how bad it is for somebody to distract an operation without really thinking through it and being intentional. So I think until you came back here, I really didn't share much with anybody in the organization of what I was reading until I was really, really, really certain that we were prepared to receive some level of change or some new methodology to how we run the business.
Interesting. All right, let's move on from the reading piece. Every firm, BJ, in our space and probably in professional services seems to say something like the difference is their people.
Yeah.
Okay. And it always struck me, I've shared this with you before, it's always struck me as a pretty lame idea. And I say that because how can every firm have the same differentiator? It's people. But maybe I'm not giving it enough credit. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on this because perhaps there's real power in assembling people with similar motivations that complement a leader in subtle ways. So you have different deficiencies and strengths than another leader might. And if you assemble the right people around you, perhaps there's power in that. Maybe to make it a little more concrete, maybe you're good at getting customers to reveal their needs. Mm. And maybe I'm good at a particular type of problem solving that customer has. So you get them to reveal and I solve it. So together, we're a powerful duo. And maybe more powerful together than either one of us would be individually or in another organization.
Yep.
So I guess I'm trying to give as much credit as I can to the idea that our differences are people, but really curious to hear your thoughts around, not so much around that hackneyed phrase, but about people and how important it is to kind of get that right in an organization.
So to steal from Jim Collins, right people, right seats, to me is everything. And to your point, sometimes the right person for the wrong client is a bad combination. And I think in the professional service space, you're an idiot if you can't say your people are your brand or your people are your most important asset. You're literally billing people's time, people's intellectual ability, time.
Work ethic.
Yeah. So I think the brand differentiator becomes when you actually create a culture that, you know, back to my why, allows people to become the best version of themselves. Because if you can really, Tom Brady might not become Tom Brady if not in the Patriots organization, right? Everything had to be right. You know, Was it Bill Belichick? Maybe, maybe not. Why can't I think of their owner right now? Everything in the environment has to be right for somebody to become who they're meant to be, I believe. And then you have to have a versatile enough leadership team, management team, processes to see when somebody's not becoming the best version. So nobody comes to work to fail. I believe that's true. Everybody would love to be a high performer. Some people may be better at figuring out on their own how to become that high performer. So I think the temptation in corporate, if you will, is eventually the bottom line becomes more important and transactional behaviors ensue, and then you have a transactional culture. And that's really hard to balance. And that is going to be our biggest challenge is the bigger we get, how intentional can we be with creating leaders that are also thinking the same way and don't get into like, well, hey, we're still making money. That person's the wrong person, but they're the person we have. It's an extremely difficult thing that we're going to try to pull off.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you my analysis of you. And I want you to tell me, first of all, do you believe it?
Okay.
And is it natural or practiced?
Okay.
Okay. So my analysis of you, one part, is that you have an above average ability to gather many inputs. We talked about your reading. Mm-hmm. And whether those be employee complaints, customer needs, strategic gaps, whatever, you gather a lot of inputs and you synthesize. Do you believe it? And is it natural or practiced?
I believe it and it's practiced.
You don't think you came to the party with that ability?
I think I came to the party with a balance of EQ and IQ. So I think I've always been able to synthesize emotions and logic, but I don't think the level of capability I'm at, it was very intentional trying to become better at it.
That's great. All right, my analysis. You're above average when it comes to self-discipline. Not surprising given your background. First of all, do you believe it? And is it natural or practiced?
This is a nature-nurture. I grew up in a pretty regimented household. So I can't say whether it was natural. It was certainly embedded at an early age. I was a swimmer. I am definitely more disciplined than the average person. So I believe it.
Waking up at 5 a.m. to go swimming in a cold pool in February in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Might have inspired that. All right. My analysis. You have above average resilience to failure. Do you believe it? Is it natural or practiced?
Cool. Failure hurts me more than I can ever show anybody else. So I think I hide it well. I'm still practicing on that one.
Fair enough. All right. We just bragged about you a little bit. What are your deficiencies? And you're going to say execution, but I'm not going to let you get away with it. That's a choice. Did I short circuit you there?
Yeah. No, I'm resilient.
There you go.
Balancing heart and head and people and profits is a really, really difficult task in the private sector. And to lose compassion would fail myself as a leader, but increase my results maybe as a business person. So I don't think it's a deficiency, but it is something I like the fact that those things are at odds and I try to balance, you know, whatever piece of that deficiency by at some point in time when you, what's the best way to say this? If you go all in on people and lose sight of profits, you lose all the people, right? You can't rehabilitate a problem or give somebody more opportunity than the organization can afford. What else are deficiencies that are worth talking about? I've got a lot of them.
You're not a profit maximizer. That's an interesting observation about yourself.
I am not a profit optimizer. To your point, a work in progress when it comes to many things, including sorting through what ideas are the best ideas to execute while also being driven and energized by many ideas at one time. Mm-hmm. So sometimes vision can get way far ahead of operational capability.
Do you have an example?
Yeah. Well, I own side hustles. I flipped houses. I was ready to, I thought I could 4-hour work week flipping houses and just hire somebody to do something and go take on more, you know, bite off more than you can chew. And even though as a systems engineer, I recognize like all the downstream processes and, you know, effects have to be in place. Biting off the who, not how, before you really have the how figured out is not a sure way to screw some things up. So that's an example. I don't know if it's a clear one, but it's crystal clear in my head.
Nothing teaches a lesson quite like losing money, right?
It's skin in the game.
Absolutely.
There's another book for you, Nassim Taleb. Yeah. What are other deficiencies? I love people. It's not a deficiency, but I want to help people, and sometimes to a fault, I can take on more than I probably have the bandwidth to. And that could be somebody I meet. That could be a nonprofit I get myself involved in unintentionally or intentionally. So my eyes are bigger than my belly.
This wasn't written down. This wasn't one of my 19 questions, but I'm going to add a 20th here.
Okay.
What would your lovely bride, Natalie, say are your deficiencies?
She would say I allow myself to get taken advantage of. Yeah. And she would say that I have a hard time being present all the time. So that's definitely something I've worked on. The cell phone is a devil, or the iPhone. What else would she say are my deficiencies? I think those would be her top two.
Present. Not being present is a good one. And I think it's probably one that many, if not most people can relate to. It's the problem of our age, I think.
Yeah. But don't let ourselves off the hook just because everybody's dealing with it. Fight against it.
Right on. Did you study the ancient Greeks at West Point?
A little bit.
See, in freshman philosophy, when you go to somewhere less elite, you have philosophy 101 when you're a freshman, and you learn about something called Plato's forms. The idea is that one of the things that makes us human is that we can visualize an ideal. So visualize for me the ideal employee.
The ideal employee, somebody who's self-aware, somebody who has work ethic, somebody who has a desire to get better and to create value, is coachable, is curious. I think those are probably it. I think everybody comes to the table and does not have an ego.
Love it. Got a few more for you.
Okay.
Visualize the ideal client for me.
The ideal client is one that values the relationship, not transactional oriented, is honest with their problems, is also self-aware and curious and kind of open to outside of the box thinking, doesn't think they already know what their solution is, but is willing to kind of whiteboard out some things outside the box, and really is a champion for whatever they're accomplishing. Because for me, our organization takes the job seriously, and we take our job as making them successful seriously, and we can't want their success more than they want their success. That probably applies to the employee as well. I can't want it for you.
Let's see if it applies in a third place. So third one, visualize for me the ideal company you'd like to acquire.
So it's one that will appreciate, accept, or be moldable to the value I think I can create through the synergy. So it's probably got to be core value aligned and culturally aligned. Can't take itself too seriously. Recognizes it has some weaknesses and maybe is surviving on the edge of successful, but knows that a leadership, an intentional leadership philosophy and people philosophy would breathe life into it.
So that's super interesting, because I think most people might say something financial or maybe even strategic. I need, you know, I want to enter this new market, so I really need a company that does X because I only do Y. You didn't answer there. What you said is culture. So your template for acquiring the perfect company would really be about its culture and its adaptability, presumably, to our culture.
Yeah. I think that's important. I think creating value is important. So you gotta know. I don't have a ton of cash. So maybe open to creative deal structure. Maybe a retiring leader that doesn't have a succession plan. Maybe in a geography that's advantageous to what we're doing. Florida, Texas. There's secondary criteria to dial in and filter out, you know, can the deal work? But priority is back to people. Culture is everything.
Love it. All right. We're in the final phase here. Accelerate. We have about 5 more minutes here. Let's talk quickly about habits. Tell me about Exodus 90.
Cold showers. I have not had a hot shower since December 31st of 2023. An hour of spiritual reading, gospel reflection, prayer time a day, workouts daily, fasting and no meat Wednesdays and Fridays, a men's 1 hour gospel reflection on Fridays. No, it's not quite no alcohol or no social media, but very, very limited.
Sounds pretty Spartan, man. I don't know who talked you into that one, but impressive, impressive. And not for all of us. All right, quick rapid fire here. You're on a desert island and can bring only one book. What is it?
Probably some kind of survival book about like how do you survive on an island.
Love it. You could have dinner with anyone past, present, or future. Who would it be?
Going George Washington, Jesus Christ, and you screwed me up. I love the ancestors, so I'm going with somebody in my great-great-grandfather-ish.
In your lineage. Oh, yeah.
Maybe my grandfather who passed away, my mom's dad who passed away when I was really young. I think he makes, after you hit that, I think he makes the cut because he knew me, but I didn't really know him. I think I was 7 when he passed.
Final thoughts. Anything that you'd like to mention that I haven't asked you?
No, this was fun. Thank you. I think you hit it all.
I could do an hour on Exodus 90. Maybe we will sometime.
Sounds like a plan.
All right, man.
All right. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Nice job.
Hey, everybody. If you're enjoying this show, do us a favor and subscribe to Inspiring People and Places on iTunes, Spotify, or your favorite podcast hosting platform. We'd also greatly appreciate if you left us a review and shared this with other entrepreneurial public servants and all your friends and family in the AEC space. Be sure to visit our website, www.mcfaglobal.com. Sign up for our newsletter to stay in touch with us and learn about all of the projects and clients we're helping. Last but not least, we are hiring. We are always hiring. Do us a favor. Take a look at what jobs we have open. Contact us through our website or connect with me on LinkedIn. Until next time, have a great rest of your week and a great weekend.